From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Since returning to the White House in January, President Trump and his new so-called Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, have moved quickly to implement major changes across the federal government. Led by billionaire Elon Musk, DOGE has cut thousands of federal jobs, canceled contracts, and targeted programs ranging from weather forecasting to medical research. Meanwhile, the Trump administration is set to implement major new tariffs on imports starting today, what the president has called Liberation Day. And yesterday, the administration acknowledged it made an error in sending at least one legal resident, a Maryland father, to a notorious prison in El Salvador. How are Democrats in Congress responding to this tidal wave of executive action? And what role might moderates play as the minority party tries to find its footing after last year's bruising election defeats? My first guest today is Congressman Brad Schneider. He represents Illinois' 10th district in the northeastern corner of the state. That includes the Chicago suburbs of Waukegan, Libertyville, Highland Park, and Winnetka. Schneider is on the Ways and Means Committee, which sets tax and tariff policy, and foreign affairs. And he was recently elected chair of the center-left New Democrat Coalition, which counts more than half of all House Democrats as members. In order to make our schedules meet, I spoke with the congressman early Wednesday morning. Congressman Brad Schneider, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
How would you describe what DOGE has done to the federal government since January?
Well, you can use any of Elon Musk's metaphor, from the bulldozer to the sledgehammer to the chainsaw. He has basically gone into the government with little appreciation, certainly, and less understanding of what government actually does and how it does it, how it serves the American people, and slashed and cut. I use the example that if he was hired to prune the trees in the forest rather than looking smart and thoughtfully at the branches that needed to be cut, he took his chainsaw to the trunk and his bulldozer to the roots.
How would you characterize the Democratic response so far?
I think it's been an outcry. And a lot of people are frustrated that Democrats in Congress aren't doing more. You know, basic civics lesson: the Republicans control the House, they control the Senate, they control the White House. Republicans can do anything they want because they have 218 votes. Democrats have to reach out to the public, raise public awareness, increase public outcry, and put the pressure on the Republicans to take action. We've seen that happen in a number of cases. Even just yesterday, not specific to DOGE, but a common sense idea that would allow new parents who are members of Congress to stay with their newborn infant and still represent the people that elected them for 12 weeks with proxy voting. This has support of not just Democrats, but a fair number of Republicans. Mike Johnson's trying to stop it. He was using a procedural maneuver. I would argue an underhanded procedural maneuver yesterday. It was overruled. Nine Republicans joined all the Democrats because of the outcry that people should be able to plan for their families. And young people should be able to run for Congress. Young members of Congress should be able to have a child and take care of their child in those first weeks of life and still represent the people who elected them. And there was a strong rebuke of the Republicans. That's because, I think, of the work the Democrats are doing.
I want to stay with this topic of the cuts and DOGE. What have you been hearing from constituents, specifically about how the cuts are affecting people in the 10th District in Northeast Illinois?
I've been hearing I'll stick with the different metaphors, but a tsunami of grief, concern, and anger. The grief, I've talked to many people who are getting emails and told that they're no longer employed, although yesterday we saw with the folks working under Robert Kennedy Jr. that rather than an email, they were told to report to work, and if their key card didn't let them in the building, they were fired. So I think that's where you just see an outrage of how it's being done. Example, and we brought a gentleman named Adam Mulvey to the president's speech to Congress. This was a guy who served 20 years in the military, three tours of duty in Iraq, one in Afghanistan, retired from the military, decided he wasn't done serving his fellow veterans or his country, Took a job with Lovell Federal Healthcare Center in North Chicago. Had been there for an 11-month period. In your first year, you're identified as a, quote, probationary officer or probationary employee. It's not a function of your performance. It's a function of how long you've worked there. At the end of the year, the probationary period is over. He was told that he was let go because of performance, yet his last paycheck reflected all the performance reviews he had received up to that point and had a bonus for his excellent work. He's subsequently been told that he was rehired. He's on paid leave for some reason. So they're technically paying him not even to come to work. Hopefully he'll get back to his work. But people hear that story, and I have that story repeated hundreds of times. And they say, this isn't how you do things. What Adam did at Lovell Healthcare Center was emergency services. He was working to make sure that, God forbid, there was a tornado or a, you know, we're going to have thunderstorms tonight in the area, that the hospital was prepared. God forbid there was something like an active shooter, that the hospital had a plan. His work was essential, and he was doing a good job. Well, that's true for EPA workers. That's true for Social Security workers, people who are processing passports, and USAID workers. I've heard from many people from around the world who grew up, still have residency in the 10th District, and are serving our nation in places far away, told, make your own way home. So it's not just what they're doing, it's how they're doing it. It's a lack of concern, a lack of care, a lack of regard for the people who made a decision to work for our nation, and being told that the nation or the current government under Trump and Musk just doesn't respect them and doesn't care about them.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st Show. We're speaking with Congressman Brad Schneider of the 10th District in far northeast Illinois. I spoke with him earlier this morning. So today is what President Trump has called Liberation Day for his new tariffs. You are on, as I mentioned earlier, you're on the House Ways and Means Committee, which sets not only tax policy, but tariff policy. What effect do you think these tariffs will have on the economy, both nationally and in Illinois?
Yeah, thanks. We're already seeing the effect of these tariffs and other tariffs that the president has put in place, as well as the way he's doing it. Tariffs are a tax on American consumers. They're a front-end tax. So, you know, take an example of someone buying a toy for their child's birthday. It's $10. A tariff says that that toy is going to cost 25% more. So instead of $10, they're going to pay $12.50. It's a back-end tax paid by the consumer. But that consumer also, when they go to the store, or go online and buy that toy, are going to pay sales tax and paying a tax again on the tariff. So it's a 1-2 punch. It means that the company that's importing those toys has to decide whether to take loss or even to bring those products in. So you're seeing fewer products on our shelves. You're seeing companies that are worried about whether they'll be able to stay in business. We did a tariff tour when I was in the district a couple of weeks ago. I talked to a company that puts together kits for kids' birthday parties, right? It's the tablecloth and the paper plates and the cups and the party hats and the banners all in a box. And they built it's a young couple with a young child, and they built a really nice business, nice enough that they have a separate room where their child can take a nap when they're home at work with them. They don't know how they'll stay in business because of the impacts of these tariffs. We're going to see today, I don't know what the president means by liberation. You're going to see today supposedly a 25% tariff added to cars. I was talking to a colleague whose family is in the automotive business and car sales, and they said they sold more cars last weekend, this past weekend, in anticipation of these tariffs than they typically do in a month. So people were rushing who needed new cars, to buy new cars ahead of the tariffs. And I suspect that the car dealers and people who were looking to buy a car next week or next month are going to pay 25% more. They're going to say, maybe I wait. So you're going to have an economic impact. And that's reflected in the broader stock market. The stock market drop, and the president's seen in his first 2 months a significant drop in the stock market. Well, keep in mind that those stocks are the assets oftentimes of people's retirement plans, their 401ks and their IRAs. So the retirement value of the retirement savings has gone down. So people are going to have to work longer, work harder, and get less in return. So it's having a real terrible impact on the economy.
And I'll just remind listeners, we did speak early Wednesday morning. The president is expected to give some remarks about these tariffs on Wednesday afternoon. So events may overtake us, depending on when people listen to this. I also want to ask you about another thing that's been in the news this week. And this one is really, I don't know, hit me personally. You never know what news story is going to resonate with someone. But yesterday, the administration acknowledged, or I guess it was Monday, deporting a Maryland father, Abrego Garcia, to El Salvador's notorious CECOT prison, quote, because of an administrative error. What does this case tell you about the administration's broader approach to immigration policy?
There's so much to this, and it's a horrible story. This is a gentleman who came here. He has been accused of being a member of a gang. He had a specific order that prohibits him from being deported, or prohibited him from being deported specifically to El Salvador, because he was rightfully fearful for his safety, security from gang violence in El Salvador. I think what you see from the administration is they don't care. They don't care about individuals' lives, families' lives that they're going to destroy. They don't care about the law. They've shown a real concerning disregard, not just for immigration law, but all kinds of laws across the country. And they don't care what the implications are. I'm going to bring it back to tariffs, just to link the two. The president, when asked about the impact of tariffs and prices will go up, he said, I don't care if prices go up. And I think that's a real reflection of how the president views not just the country in general, but even the people who helped elect him. He doesn't care. He doesn't care that they elected him to bring down prices. He's going to raise prices. He doesn't care that they elected him to make America more secure in the world. He's continuing to cozy up to folks like Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban. He doesn't care what the implications are of closing down the Department of Education and hurting families who depend on the department. If they have kids with special needs, if they're trying to pay for higher education with student loans, all that's going to be affected. He doesn't care about the implications of decimating CDC, Center for Disease Control, National Institute of Health. Imagine if you have cancer and the clinical trial you were a part of that has the prospect of extending or even saving your life just got defunded. Or God forbid you're diagnosed with cancer next year or the year after, and there's not going to be the clinical trials that might have saved your life then. All of that relates to exactly what we're seeing with the president's cavalier approach to deporting people, whether they're innocent or whether they deserve to be deported.
Yeah, and I should say, I think in this case, the judge determined that he was not a gang member, at least that there wasn't sufficient evidence he was. His lawyers are asking this federal judge to order the government to negotiate for his release, but Trump administration officials, and I'm reading here from the Washington Post, officials said they are powerless because he's in Salvadoran custody, and they downplayed the risks he faces in prison, saying Abrego Garcia's lawyers have not clearly shown that he would be tortured or killed. Is that the end of this story?
Absolutely not. We're going to make sure that we keep this story in the news. You see with this administration, just a sense of it's not my responsibility. It's not my fault. It's not my problem. So when things happen that either are a violation of the law or have adverse consequences, President Trump will say, oh, I don't know anything about that. Or other members of the cabinet and start pointing fingers. And you can look at the example of the signal chat with classified information. You saw just a broad circle of incompetence of people who are saying, well, I didn't do it. It wasn't me. And it didn't happen. Well, if it did happen, it was their fault. If it was their fault, they didn't mean to do it. And they continue to, you're dealing with what feels like sometimes a preschool class running around in circles. It's a reflection of their incompetence. It's a reflection of their indifference. And it is a real threat to, I think, U.S. security interests, in this case with the signal gate, but also the security and safety of individual citizens. In this case, what we're talking about with Abrego he is not a citizen. He was an immigrant. He was the courts ruled that it was inadmissible to send him back to El Salvador. But this could have been a citizen. And the administration just says, well, not my fault. Nothing I can do. Not my problem. It is their problem. It's all of our problems.
All right. We need to take a break on the program. When we come back, we'll have more from my conversation with Congressman Brad Schneider, recorded earlier this morning. He's on the House Ways and Means Committee. He's also on Foreign Affairs, and we'll talk about his strong support for Israel and what it means that support for Israel is significantly weakening among Democratic constituents. We're also going to talk about the New Democrat Coalition, of which he is the chair, a center-left group, and why he thinks they have a better handle on how to make Democrats relevant in American governance again, as opposed to the sort of progressive left. And then later in the program, we're going to be talking with Aziz Rana, a constitutional scholar, about whether we are already in a constitutional crisis. All that is coming up after a short break here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, talking with Congressman Brad Schneider, who represents Illinois' 10th District in the northeastern corner of the state. He also chairs the New Democrat Coalition. We spoke early this morning, so no calls for this part of the show, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. You're on the Foreign Affairs Committee. You're also a supporter of Israel, and you spent a year working on a kibbutz when you were a young man. For some of our listeners who may not be familiar, last month, Gallup reported Democrats sympathize with the Palestinians over the Israelis by a nearly 3-to-1 ratio now, 59% versus 21%. Why do you think that is?
Well, I didn't see the poll. I've seen other polls. I know that Democrats and Americans in general sympathize with the plight of the hostages that are held by Hamas nearly 18 months after Hamas invaded Israel. They still hold 59 people, including 5 Americans. I think the American people sympathize with Israelis' desire to live in peace. I chair the Abraham Accords Caucus. The idea that Israelis and Arabs belong to the same land, that we need to find a path for both of them to live together in peace, side by side, a Jewish democratic state of Israel. Ultimately, a Palestinian state that respects Israel's right to exist, but also has the right to their own self-determination, part of a broader region with other Abraham Accord member countries who are fully integrated, fully aspiring to lift up the region, give opportunity to its citizens and be partners for peace, not just with each other, but with the rest of the world. That's what I'm focused on. It's what I'll continue to focus on as long as I'm in Congress.
But if this issue becomes polarized, as so many others have in America, and Democrats really turn their backs on Israel, by and large, and maybe not Democratic office holders, but your constituents, more broadly speaking, or Democratic constituents across the country, that's a big problem for Israel, right? And American supporters of Israel.
Well, I have always fought to make sure that support for Israel stays bipartisan. I think it continues to be bipartisan. You can look just as an example. Last week, we voted on legislation. There were 2 amendments introduced by Rashida Tlaib that were specifically targeted towards Israel. One was overwhelmingly rejected with only 3 Democrats voting for it. The rest, every other Democrat voted against it. A second one, I think, may have had 4 Democrats voting for it and 1 abstaining or 1 voting present. And the rest voting against it. I think you saw unity within our party supporting Israel's right to security, to safety. But I think most Americans also recognize that Israelis and Palestinians have to live together. This is not an either or Israeli versus Palestinian. It's an either or peace or Hamas continues to control Gaza. As long as Hamas is in Gaza, there won't be peace. Hamas has to not just be defeated, but removed from controlling Gaza If they continue to control Gaza, to threaten Israel, to call for Israel's destruction. We saw just, I think it was this week, the president of Turkey, Erdogan, calling for the destruction of Israel. Israel's in a very dangerous neighborhood. It's a critically important ally to the U.S., but that doesn't mean that we can't support Israel and also support the aspirations of Palestinians seeking to live in peace and give their children the same future that Israelis want for their children.
I know we're coming to the end of our time together. I want to ask about the new Democrat coalition. You were elected chair of this group. It's 115. I think you all describe yourselves as pragmatic center-left House Democrats. That's a majority of the minority caucus. How do you see your role in shaping the Democratic response to the Trump administration?
Thank you. I think we have a very important role in leading the response, helping lead the response. As you mentioned, we are a majority of the Democratic caucus. We have grown. New Dems are that center, the ones who are willing to roll up our sleeves, get things done, recognize that you can't get everything you want every time. You need to take things in steps forward and work not just across the caucus, but at times across the aisle. That's a hard thing to do right now because the Republicans are really under the thumb of President Trump. But we saw yesterday with this bill to try to give parents leave to take care of their kids and continue to represent their constituents that we can. Nine Republicans joined us on that. We will continue to push for the priorities that reflect the interest of the American people. That is a growing economy, trying to create quality, well-paying jobs so people can not just make ends meet, but get ahead, clearing away obstacles and opening paths to opportunity. We're going to continue to focus on providing people places where they can live with confidence and security, feeling safe in their homes, but also on their way to work, to school, to play, that they have access to quality health care, that their kids get the education they need to succeed for the future. And we're going to continue to make sure that the United States has strong national security, national defense. We will continue to work, you mentioned foreign affairs, to work to make sure that the United States is working with our allies rather than against our allies, as President Trump is seeking to do, and that we're trying to make it a safer place for Americans here at home and around the world.
And at the same time, though, Bernie Sanders, Senator from Vermont, AOC, Congresswoman from New York, they're getting tens of thousands of people turning out for their rallies. Why do you think new Democrats have a better handle on the future of the party and American politics than the progressive left?
Well, I'll just point to some numbers. New Dems, when I came to Congress in 2013, there were 42 new Dems in the caucus. Today, we're at 115. In the last election, which was an election where the Democrats faced significant headwinds, New Dems won 85 of 87 elections for our incumbent members, and we added 25 new members. We flipped in a year where Democrats lost the Senate and weren't able to take the majority in the House. New Dems flipped nine Republican seats, turning them Democratic. We're seeing people gravitate to us, and we're seeing it with current members, incumbent members who have been here. Some have been here for serving in their 15th term, saying, you know what? We like the New Dem message. We want to be a part of it. So already this year, we've added five new members, which is, I think, certainly in my time in Congress, the most we've added after an election of incumbent members saying we want to join you. So we have a message. We have a message that resonates. And we have a record of accomplishment of getting things done.
Congressman Brad Schneider, thank you for sharing your views on the 21st show.